Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. Tonight we look at what it takes to be successful as an entrepreneur and in business. To help us with that is a little tune that I think you all might recognize. And, you know, you can't be successful with a little Deep Purple. And tonight, our first guest is a man who has done it all, I think, on more than one continent. He's dipped in and out of accounting, banking, finance, education. He's a Renaissance man, if you will, with the flavors for success. And with no further ado, I would like to introduce you to Zagim Hack. Welcome to Eye on Careers.
Hi, Shane. Thank you for having me on your show.
And you're also a rocker as well as a businessman. So I think this is one of the greatest classic rock songs that you can possibly get. Zagim, you have worked across so many different industries and eventually decided to be the master of your own ship. Just for our audience, can you maybe just give us a quick overview of, you know, your career history?
Sure. I'm an economics graduate from the University of Essex way back in the late 70s. And soon after I graduated, I joined a small practice in Richmond, and I did my chartered accountancy, so I'm a member of the ICAEW. And I guess that's where I got my sort of appreciation for a fairly broad range of businesses because of the sheer variety of audits I had to do. After my accountancy, soon after I qualified, I moved across to the city. This was around just after the time of the Big Bang in London. So everybody wanted to work in the city. We trainee accountants.
The Big Bang?
The Big Bang.
I didn't know that. I missed that one. I don't know. Are we allowed to talk about that on the radio?
That was, you know, when the markets went bananas, the housing markets went, you know, ballistic. And that's when you suddenly, you know, when Porsche started really selling cars in the city. So, and that's what, you know, as a trainee accountant, you'd sort of be taking your luncheon vouchers and, you know, standing in a line and in, you know, folks you'd graduated with and who were working in the city were doing so well financially. So that became an aspiration. I was very lucky. Soon after I qualified, I got a break and I joined a city trading company. They traded foreign exchange, financial markets across the world. And I got to work in that company in the city for about a year. And then I moved with them back in 1988 to Dubai. A lot of their clientele were Middle Eastern, and they wanted to have an operation here in Dubai directly servicing those accounts, and my job was to come and set that office up.
If I ever could just go back for a minute, though, you went and became an ICAEW Chartered Accountant, an Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales, which to some people seems like a lot of work. Was it worth it? Is it worth it? If someone's out there thinking about getting qualified, should they go for it?
Is it worth it and is it a lot of work? I think it's the hardest I've ever worked in my life. It was very, very tough.
The hardest you've ever worked in your life?
I think
seriously.
It was. Seriously. I'm not a natural studying sort of a person, and the amount of work I had to do just to get through those exams was mind-boggling. I actually was weak at the end of the exams. I could barely stand by it, but put so much effort into it. Was it worth it? I've not been in the profession for most of my working life. After I qualified, I joined this practice in the city, but I've retained my membership every year. I think it's such an intensive process. It gets, you know, what you learn gets beaten into your DNA, and it shapes the sort of person you become. I think I can get into any business. I think I can do any business. I've done such a variety of things, and I think a lot of that is because of my ICAEW grounding.
Accounting is the language of business.
Accounting is the language of business, and in the process of qualifying, and then in the process of working, you know, it's not one type of organization. You get into so many different types of organizations, and to be able to assess what, you know, how they're doing their financials, are they true and fair, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to actually understand that business. You've got to understand how it ticks. If you can understand businesses, you can do your own business.
So for you, that was a game changer, much more valuable than your university degree.
They were both very valuable. I think the university degree kind of widened my mind.
You're just saying that it's because you met your wife while you were at university, I think.
And that is true. I met my wife in my first week at university.
Your first week?
My first week.
Was it love at first sight?
It was, actually.
You have to say that, though, on live radio. You can't say no.
Because she might be listening, yes. But it was. It really was. It sounds very corny, but it was.
So you were two lovebirds from first sight, and that's it.
I think I was smitten well before she was.
Okay, so, but I hear you guys have a bit of a mango. You fight about the mangoes.
She's from the wrong side of the border. Yes, and she supports the wrong cricket team, and she doesn't know anything about mangoes.
Oh my God, you're gonna pay for that. But so you go into trading after surviving what you said was a soul crushing experience at the accounting firm. Is that right?
It was a soul-crushing experience. Yeah. Certainly, I think it broke a little something in my spirit, I think. And one of the things was I needed to travel. I'd been in the UK now for about 8 or 9 years, and I needed to a change of scenery. I just needed to get away.
But isn't it sometimes you have to know what you're not before you know what you are?
I think you do.
So going into these, you know, and I think the other thing about it is you went in full speed. You didn't go, you know, I'm going to try this or do that. You're like, no, I'm going to become ICAW certified. I'm going to go into the accounting firm. I'm going to, you know, and it's only when you're going at that top speed, really pushing yourself, that you realize these are the things you don't want to do.
And a word of advice: this is not for the faint-hearted. You don't decide to become a chartered accountant as a sort of a, let me try and see what it's going to be like. You really need to figure out that is a direction you want to take, and it's going to take a lot of commitment.
So then the next sexiest thing, and you know, I think everybody, even if you're not in business or banking or in trading, we've probably seen the movie The Pursuit of Happiness. So this is it, right? You know, you get in, you become a trader. This is the big time. And so tell us what happened there.
I was with a small boutique city investment firm. They were doing tremendous amounts of volume. And the business was fantastic. I remember, you know, we'd work crazy hours in London, and then we'd go and eat at 9 or 10 or 11 o'clock at the best restaurants. It was that sort of a lifestyle. It was the heady days, you know. It was everything I thought I would like to do. And when I moved to Dubai to set up the operation over here and head it, it was what I thought was my ticket to what I'm going to do till I retire. Of course, the real world is a little different. My employers got caught up in a city scandal. Global expansion was taken off their agenda immediately. And I had a choice to make. I'd either got to go back to the UK or I could stay on here and try to find another job. And I chose to stay on in Dubai back in 1989.
Wow. So you're one of the original players out here.
It was already a well-established, though very different market to what it is today.
Okay, so and that's when you joined the Dow Jones, or you were with Middle East Bank, I think.
I left Capcom Financial Services, my UK employer, and joined Middle East Bank. It is a bank that was part of the Al Futtaim family in those days, and I joined their dealing room. I had a background in trading. I joined the dealing room, and one of the things I was they were very interested in developing their corporate and their client business. So one of the things I set up over there was a margin trading franchise, which was quite a successful venture for them. And I think that's when I got a taste of business development and knew that was something I was really good at.
Okay, so this is a story of Zagim Hack. He's the founder of SCAFA, which stands for the School of Culinary and Finishing Arts. We're going to be hearing more about how he took the leap into starting his own business, not once, but twice, and what his lessons learned on the road to the top are. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
All right, welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are talking to a man who has the flavor for success. His name is Zagim Hack. Zagim, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Hi, Shane.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So, you know, as we were going through your background, we realized that, you know, you've done quite a few things. And in fact, sometimes you have to find out what you're not before you know what you are. But the thing that allowed you, or your passport that allowed you to try so many businesses, was your ICAEW, Chartered Accounting Qualification, which basically is your passport into the boardroom, as some executives say.
I think that's right. I think perhaps what that's taught me is business is business. It doesn't matter whether you're building a records management business, an education business, or a business is a business. You've got to have a proposition. You've got to have systems to deliver that proposition. You've got to have an operations system. A business is a business. I've been a businessman now several times over, and every time I've gone into business, it's a very specialized area. And I've not had core competency myself, but I've decided that there's value in the proposition, and I think I can get it going. So, and I think that's my ICAEW background.
Okay, so been believing in the value. So where we had just left off, for those just joining us, you had gone to university in the UK, got your ICAEW qualification at an accounting firm. Then you joined an investment bank as a trader, and then came to Dubai to set up their office here in Dubai. Bit of scandal in the head office. They retreat from Frontier Markets. You're left in a receding tide. And then you start with Middle East Bank as a trader, and then move into Dow Jones.
That's right.
And then from Dow Jones, is that when you decide to start your first business?
Towards the end. I was in Dow Jones for about 7 years. I was hired initially to get the company's operations up and running in Saudi Arabia. So I moved to Riyadh and I lived there for 4 years. And this was very soon after the first Gulf War, and Saudi was on a rebuild mode. And you had to be really stupid. Even if you were stupid, you would do really well in Saudi. And I was lucky to be there at the right time. So
it didn't take a lot of intelligence to bring in the amount. I guess when you look at the amount of intellectual horsepower per dollar of profit, was perhaps lower than other geographies.
It was, but I think I was dealing with very talented people over there also. But, you know, they were on a spending spree. And the scale of everything over there was just different. You know, a dealing room in Saudi Arabia in those days, was a room with 50 to 100 dealers. In Dubai, the biggest dealing rooms were about 8 or 9 dealers in those days. Mm. So, you know, it was a completely different scale of operation. And to be in there, establishing a company, building relationships with these very big financial institutions, it rapidly became the fastest growth center for Dow Jones globally.
Wow. But I do find this an interesting statistic, is your intellectual horsepower per dollar of profit. And so if you look at it, a lot of people come out of the top business schools, you know MBA from this big huge branded school or whatever it is, and then they go and they pick a profession where all the other guys who graduated from the, you know, biggest best schools and have the big juiciest IQs are also going into. So net you're arbitrage right out. So your big juicy IQ and your big heavyweight MBA degree is not going to help you at all, because you're going into strategy consultant, private equity, investment banking, where the guy on the other side of the tables, it has the same thing, you know. And then if you go into something, you know, like selling, I don't know, I don't want to say, I don't want to say what would be a lower, you know, but you know, if you choose an industry, and I don't think Fadi Malass would mind, but you know, he has a degree from master's degree from Imperial College, obviously a very sharp guy, one of the many key architects behind Just Falafel. And, you know, they applied this huge amount of intellectual horsepower into a simple business like Just Falafel. And boom, you have a huge success. He builds the world's largest falafel chain of restaurants in less than 3 years. So I always find it an interesting kind of little piece of information when you watch what people are doing with their careers. But and you did the opposite. I mean, everyone was going right. London was the place to be, and you head into the pioneering markets. Again, you must have been one of the only chartered accountants in town, or UK chartered accountants.
No, even back then in the early 90s, you had well established all the big players were in there. In those days you still had the Big Eight, and they all had local affiliations, so they were, I actually met a lot of very skilled, very talented people over there. Remember, I'd worked in Dubai, I'd now gone to Saudi Arabia, and I was the thing is, Saudi was a market which paid top dollar in those days, so there was a premium to work there, so they managed to still get a lot of very good talent in.
Okay, so you're saying now that there's a complete surplus of talent, chartered accountants, UK qualified professionals, that the region's teeming with this kind of talent.
No, I'm talking back then. It wasn't as scarce as I thought you were suggesting it might have
okay.
been.
Okay, but back then it was teeming with talent.
It wasn't teeming, but there were a lot of qualified people around. I was one of them.
One of them, okay. But that's why they're paying a premium, right? Because there's not that many to pick from. But so you take this route, you head into Dow Jones. But what was the point where you said, that's it, you know, I'm done being, playing the corporate game. I'm going to set sail on my own ship now.
Actually, that was kind of pushed on to me. It was a wonderful corporate life. I was a very, very successful salesman in Dow Jones. I was building relationships and building businesses in different geographies. I had an unlimited expense account. I traveled a lot.
Unlimited, that's nice.
But because I was, nobody ever questioned my bills because I was just doing so well. I was entertaining people, picking up bankers, taking them to see systems in Stockholm or in Nice or whatever it is. And it was just the way business was done. And it was backed with a lot of success. So it was a great life. What happened was, outside of my control, out in New York, Dow Jones from the division I worked in, Dow Jones Markets, from being the blue-eyed boys within the Dow Jones family, was suddenly seen as the reason corporate profits were lagging and the share price was stagnant in those days at around $40, and it wasn't moving. So the owners of Dow Jones in those days, the Bancroft family, now I think it's Rupert Murdoch, but then the Bancroft family turned to Warren Buffett and asked for advice. And his advice to them was, act like owners. And so they decided to sell off the division. Now, this was a very large division all over the world with, substantial offices. And it was up for sale. And it was a time which would normally, it was a very stressful time for people.
Sure. So you didn't have a choice in the matter. You're forced to spread your wings, and you pick this company, Dockman. I mean, how did you decide to do that?
Actually, the first thing I did was I tried to buy out the division, Dow Jones.
Ah, okay.
And I put together a management team. We attempted an MBO with a VC. It was one hell of a roller coaster ride. Became very, very hostile. Eventually, it was abortive. It wasn't successful. In hindsight, it's quite good it wasn't, because the internet was now about to happen, and real-time financial system suppliers were about to
come into the market.
Yeah. So it was perhaps just as well that we were unsuccessful in getting that. But as a result of that, I ended up working in the VC, and got involved in establishing some of their projects. They used to invest in greenfield initiatives and bring them onto the market and then flog them. That's when I got into Dockman. One of their greenfield business plans was looked very interesting. Circumstances changed. I was in a position to buy it. I did, rebranded it as Docman and built Docman as my first business venture.
Which did exactly what?
Docman was a document management company. It managed records. There was a big climate-controlled facility that we built in the Jabal Ali Free Zone, the first of its kind in this region. And then we did a lot of BPO work, digitization, data processing for banks, etc. So clientele was banks, government agencies, multinationals, etc. And this business was, I developed this business, our imaging business became the most successful business of its kind in the Middle
sure.
East.
So then you sold it and...
And we came onto Aramex's radar. Aramex saw this as part, you know, Aramex wanted to be in every part of the supply chain process. And they saw records management as part of that, as a small sliver in that spectrum of services.
Okay, so they buy the business and then you're out, and this is where you make a good profit, I guess we could say. You go for a three-year vacation.
I went on a three-year vacation.
And then getting back in the workforce after that was a challenge, or late 40s at this point. And how do you get back into the rat race after that?
Well, it was interesting. You know, it was a, do I do business or do I try to get back into corporate life? Now, getting back into corporate life, I'm not trying to develop myself. I'm not trying to build a CV. So I have a fairly experienced CV. So I decided... What would earn me the best return? What's the best paying jobs out there? And I thought private equity, that's the space to be in. So I approached friends I had in private equity. And as it happened, a private equity firm had invested into one of the big education groups, GEMS, the biggest. And with their help, I was introduced to the chairman of GEMS, Sunny Varki. They were looking for a COO, series of interviews, and I became the COO at GEMS.
And so is it true, did you joining the private equity, was it that lucrative, or is this a bit of a myth?
No, I think private equity is a very lucrative space to be in, and remains to a very lucrative space. Sure, you know, after the crash, private equity to be really, really successful, you know, you need leverage, you need to be able to leverage deals, et cetera, et cetera. All of that took a little bit of a knock, you know, after the crash 2008, 2009, but it's back, and it is lucrative. The payouts can be very, very good, especially, you know, with quality firms like Abraj.
Sure. Okay. But did you, coming in as an executive though, you don't really get to touch that, do you?
No, actually, I never got into private equity. My approach to them, I got pushed into one of their portfolio companies,
right,
if you like.
Right. So I think, you know, those, my point is that there's only like such a small percentage of people in private equity who are actually making money. And so many of the other people are, you know, they never really seem to crack that ceiling because, you know, the whole game is, you know, you have to get carry, and the carry doesn't really hold weight until you're part of the investment team, until your money's actually in the deal. Because, in my humble opinion, the management fee plus the 20% when it's all split, you're not really getting there unless you're actually putting your own money into the investments. Those are the guys who are putting their own money in. Those are the guys who are the ones who are actually making something. As long as you say as a pure employee or a staff or the deal like you took, you're making okay money. I mean, your lights are on. I mean, you're taking a nice vacation. You know, it's not like you're suffering. You're still probably in the top 10%, but you're not making the money that's attracting people to private equity. True or false? I mean, that's just my opinion.
No, I think the seriously, seriously big bucks are obviously made by the people who are equity holders in the management company that is the private equity business, right? And if they're very, very good, then they'll attract funds, and they you know, I think that the trick over there is to set this up, you need to be the it isn't who you invest in, it's the investment funds that you can generate in the first place to be very successful in private equity.
This is Zagim Haque. He's the founder of SCAFA, which is the School of Culinary Arts and Finishing Arts. He'll be giving us his story of how he started his business in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Zegam Hack, the founder of SCAFA, which is a school of culinary and finishing arts. Zegam, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
It's good to be here, Shane.
Just for you, for those out there, you know, we are having a competition. If you know who is the highest paid CEO of 2013, I think we had Omar Hadi sending in a response. He missed it just by a slight bit. I believe that John Hammergreen was the CEO of McKesson. He is the highest paid CEO for 2012. So he missed it by a year. Close miss there. And if anyone thinks they know who it is, you can SMS us at 4001. That's 4001. Or you can use your mobile app and contact us directly. So, Zegam, I don't know if you have a guess on who's the highest paid CEO 2013. No?
No, I don't. I'd guess it'd be somebody in an investment bank.
Right. I mean, but I think obviously bankers do make good money. But, you know, what I believe is that every industry, whether it's cleaning windows, selling peanuts, investment banking, media, whatever it is, there's a billionaire every industry. You know, when you look at that top person, they're all making big money. And it actually almost becomes, it doesn't really matter what your profession is. You know, those people who decide they're gonna make it big, they're the ones that do it. It doesn't matter which business you're in. Every business is good. And those people who are at the bottom of the pyramid or feel that their industry isn't any good, you know, I would urge them not to switch industry. But you've done the opposite. You've switched industries more than I think almost anyone I've ever met. And so do you recommend that? Or if you look back on your career path, would you have kind of played it a bit more straight-laced in terms of your industry exposure?
I think every time I've set out to do something, I've always tried to do it with the view to doing something that would be the last thing I do. So I've never started something with I didn't start DocMan with a view to exit in a certain number of years. I exited because we were doing really, really well. We had private equity on board, invested into DocMan. We needed to find exits for them, circumstances, etc. So
that's it. It's more circumstantial.
Yeah.
So so you're in with Sonny Varkey, one of the legendary businessmen of the region, and fairly successful as well. And then you exit that business when your private equity business exits as well.
Before that, yes.
And so then, what is it that? And that's when you start your own business again for the second time now.
That's when I started looking at deciding. One of the reasons I left was because I wanted to set up my own business again.
Okay. And so what was the clincher for that? What was the kind of real catalyst where you woke up that morning and say, that's it, I'm resigning today? Those are the magical days, right, when you quit.
I think it was a conversation in a taxi with friends going out to eat at a restaurant in London, which had reviewed really well. And somebody said, why don't you bring the cordon bleu to Dubai? And that little seed, we laughed about it, but it stuck in my mind.
And that was it. And then so after that trip, you came back and handed your resignation?
No. After that trip, I came back and hired a consultancy firm. I was really busy. I was working, attritional hours in those days. So I didn't have the bandwidth to do anything like that. So I got, but I didn't want to let this go. So I paid a consultancy to just do some feasibilities for me.
How much does that cost?
It wasn't expensive. Initial feasibilities were about 35,000 dirhams.
35,000 dirhams. Money well spent, you think?
It was money that I had to spend if I wanted to explore this.
Okay, so the study comes back and it says great business, or it says okay business, or it says you'll go bust.
Well, actually, the study was still a work in progress, and then I parted company with GEMS, very amicable, and but we all had good reasons for it. And so I actually took the study back myself from the consultants and developed it. And, everything was a go about it. This is one of the things about business. You know, you want to line up all your ducks. It never works like that. You've got to take a leap of faith. You make it as small as possible, but you got to take a punt.
And were you scared?
Always.
You're petrified. But you had enough startup capital for this? Or, I mean, a school of culinary and finishing arts sounds like, you know, there's a fair amount of capital involved with the ovens, the this, the that.
We built the school. Yeah. We built the premises. They're purpose-built premises.
Wow.
It's a capital-intensive led business. It's one of those. I wish I'd thought of something which required very little upfront investment and where I could rake in the money. But unfortunately, this required a lot of upfront investment, and then you have to be patient and build.
So you built the building, and you own the whole building. Is used for the school, or do you rent part of the school out?
No. We built this. We took a certain amount of premises within the JLT area, Jumeirah Lake Stars. It's called detached retail. We were the first people to do this, and then we built a school inside that retail area. So it's about 6,000 square feet, and it's 100% school.
Oh, it's 100%. But there's a retail space there that you also own. So you hedge a bit of your risk.
No, we took this retail space and converted it into a school.
Ah, okay.
To build it into a school.
So you're leasing the. Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay, so and so you start in 2012.
Yes.
And now you have to manage everything. I mean, you're not a chef. How do you know if the chef's any good, or he's like, this is what the curriculum needs to look like? How, you know, as an entrepreneur diving into something totally new, how do you manage your knowledge gaps?
Well, with a lot of trust, I guess. No, but by carefully hiring people who I think are going to be very, very good at their work. I'm very lucky. I think I've got a great team led by some fantastic people. We've got a fantastic faculty. We have proprietary IP now. We have our own curriculums, our own processes, etc. And we're now expanding those, and we're building new schools.
So you just have to trust the person you hire, and
you have to hire the best person you can, and you have to work closely with them and make sure that what you're looking for is what they're delivering.
Right, right. And then doing the marketing, branding, you know, are you leading that, or are you hiring a marketing person as well?
We had an ad agency, we had a PR agency we retained their services to help us promote the school. We work with one of the best web development companies also. And it's a difficult one. This is the first time I ventured into a B2C, a business-to-consumer type of business. And I think I have tremendous expertise in doing B2B type of business, you know, the big sell, the consultative sell. But here we're trying to enroll students, professional students, into high-value courses. And it's been hard to find the way to do it. I actually thought that there's a ready-made market over here of, you know, you've got about 17,000, 18,000 kids, I think, graduating out of schools here every year. And they would be the obvious target market for us. But that's proven to be a lot more difficult. So we've gone down many, many different avenues trying to figure out the best way to promote this business.
Okay, and so when you look at it, you know, everything that you've done, what's really been the biggest challenge for you? You know, when you look at the biggest challenge of your career or of your life that you had to face.
The biggest challenge, I think, the challenge with business is always ensuring you make it survive. You know, you keep it going, you keep the cash flows going, you get the salaries out, you get the revenues in, you keep betting the business again and again on its expansion. I think in Darkman, we had a terrible time once in our second year where we were really, you know, on the edge of a cliff, and we had to thin out our management team, and it looked like we didn't have a choice. And that was one of the hardest things I thought I'd ever do.
Dot-com, though, but describe on the edge of a cliff, what does that look like?
Oh, I've stood there many times. It's all about cash flow. The edge of the cliff is cash flow. When you don't have the cash flow.
And so I guess, is it that the clients are extending their days payable, your receivables are stretching out, so on paper the company looks good, you come in and the cash flow's not there? Or is it that your business was too early for its time, people aren't really investing in document management at that point in time?
It can be those sorts of things. It can even be a lot of sales success. So suddenly you find that you've sold a tremendous amount of project type of business, which is what we did in Docman, and you now need to deliver it. And you need to deliver it, you need to set it up. And to set it up, you need to get funding and financing, because that's you need to invest to get to actually deliver that business. As an SME, you don't have access to financing, and you can't take the contracts that you have and get any advances against them. That can be the edge of your cliff.
Is basically, you know, you win a big contract, hiring the people, systems, everything to deliver that contract, you need to invest, and they're not going to pay you till you finish it.
We got a contract from the Dubai municipality to convert every single blueprint that they have for the whole of the Emirate of Dubai, for every single building, and digitize it. Great contract to win. Fought off all the competition, secured the business. Then we had to invest in creating a scanning operation. You know, that was about an investment of between $500,000 to $1 million dirhams at the time. If we couldn't produce it, we'd lose the contract.
Wow. So, and they're not going to give financing to the SMEs.
You can't get SME financing.
So what did you do?
We did a whole bunch of things. You know, you just get so creative what we did is, I went to about 20 different banks, and eventually one of them, I remember in those days, National Bank of Umm Al Quwaim, they suddenly said, oh, that does sound interesting. So you got this project. And eventually, lots and lots of paperwork later, we got a clean line of credit. It was incredibly hard, but we were really close to just losing this contract.
Wow! So you got a line of credit, and off you go out of the gates. But it was actually, you pounded the pavement 20 times.
I can tell you, when in Docman, when we needed early, second round for funding, we went to private equity. We needed private equity injections to keep the company going. We did an IM. We got our business plans ready. I went to more than 65 prospective investors before we got investment.
65?
It was just after 9/11. The dot-com bubble had burst. Trying to get any private equity type of funding was like trying to get blood out of a stone.
That's the thing, though. I almost feel like if you're SME and say, okay, fine, maybe if you're asking for, 20 million dirhams or more, then, the time investment to go and see 65 people is fine. But if you're only looking for like 1 million or 2 million dirhams, it's almost easier just to go make the money yourself, because the same, it must take you at least a year to go through 65 investment calls.
It took me 6 months to do this with the help of an investment advisor, who he was connecting me to angel investors through to financial institutions and private equity funds. The ticket size, the smallest ticket size in those days was $1 million.
So, but at this point, you're not running the business, though, because you're raising the money for it, right? Or are you raising the money and you're doing the investment calls?
You're doing everything.
So that it doesn't make sense how you can do that. I mean, but we're going to find out more about this. This is Zagim Haq, the founder of SCAFA, the School of Culinary and Finishing Arts. And he's giving us his secrets on how he starts his businesses. He's been described many times as a serial entrepreneur, and we'll have more from him.
Dubai i 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. It's Shane Phillips here. I'm your host, and we are here with Zagim Haq, who's the founder of the School of Culinary Arts and of Culinary and Finishing Arts. Zagim, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Good to be here.
So we were just talking about the amount of work that you go through, whether it's raising debt or selling equity in your business. You went to see 20 banks to raise a credit line for your Docman business, and over 65 investment meetings to raise equity. And I think the average person gives up after the first 3 or 4 or 5. You really have to be determined, almost very rejection friendly in a way.
You do. If you're going to start a business, and it's going to be start off as a small business, you got to ensure that you have the funding to see you through to at least the end of your second year. Hopefully by then you'll have enough revenue, surplus revenue, to keep you going. but also if, you know, by the end of your first year, you need to start recognizing what your funding requirements might be by the end of the second year and start working on them.
Right. And so it's almost a full-time job, right? You know, managing this side of the business.
It is a time-consuming effort.
Okay, so you go and now you're 2 years into the business. If you look back on the last 2 years, you could change anything. What would be, you know, your biggest changes, or where were the points where you'd really do something different than what you've done?
You know, we sort of estimated our opportunities poorly at times. And we have a much better understanding of where we need to focus our energy and our effort. But there's no shortcut to this sort of stuff. We are where we are today, and we're very experienced. We've got a lot more experience now. There was no easy way of doing this. But we now know what we're going to do when we open our second, third, and fourth schools.
What, differently?
Very differently.
And what's the difference?
First of all, we know what really prospective students are really looking for, where they will turn to find your type of service. We know what type of people to not employ, and we know the kind of people we wish to employ much better than we did at the beginning.
What do you look for in the people you want to employ versus the ones you don't want to employ?
First, we're a teaching academy. We're teaching people to join the hospitality sector. We want teachers to sort of belong to the hospitality. So first of all, they've got to have the right attitude, suitable for somebody who's training people to join a hospitality industry. We want skills. We want to be seen as a school that delivers excellence in teaching, and that our students will be very successful. So we're always looking for people right at the cutting edge of modern technique. So, for instance, we're building our pastry program. We're going to look for people with techniques out of Spain, because that's where pastry is now. It's not in Paris.
It's not?
No.
They lost that, huh?
And
it's a decline. Is that could be like a major sign that France is, you know, they lost the pastry, you know, that you just said that. That could be, you know, kind of a death nail for them.
Zegam has spoken.
No, but I mean the fact that, I mean, not necessarily that you decided that pastry, but the fact is, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't lay it to the French on the radio. But so the Spaniards took that. I thought, you know, when you think of Spanish, you think of bullfighting and tomato throwing and the bull run and all, and I don't know where they squished pastry making into that.
Well, no, you know, El Bulli, their restaurant, you know, that was what changed the world of cooking forever, you know.
Which one was it?
El Bulli, you know, best restaurant in the world until it went bankrupt for years and years and years. And then Noma became the best restaurant in the world. And then briefly last year, El Cella in Spain again became the best restaurant in the world.
But not for their pastries, though, wasn't it?
No, not for the pastry, but funky pastry, modern pastry, as opposed to your standard mille feuilles or whatever it is. It's coming out of Spain.
They're the innovative pastries. Yeah. I see what you're saying now, whereas France still has their traditional foothold.
And so we want to be, that's where we want to be with the programs we teach. We want to be a modern school.
Want to be innovative.
Innovative, right there.
And that's, what better city to do that in than Dubai? So you look for innovative people on the cusp of their industry. And what don't you look for? I mean, what are some of the worst interviews you've had where you're like, wow, did that, you know, or can you say that on the radio?
There are a lot of people who think they have a strong culinary background, and quite often they don't. And we get a lot of CVs in, and we just reject oodles and oodles of CVs,
and get rid of those. So, what is your advice now to anyone who wants to go out and start their own business?
Be decisive. Most people are employed as opposed to running their own businesses because they don't take the plunge. You know, they may have a good idea. It doesn't have to be unique. It just needs to be something that you think you can see through to success. Have the capital, number one reason for failure. You didn't have the money to see it through. It's bad, lean times. And this is the interesting thing about Dubai. This is the thing where that I've done wrong, I think. I think that if you want to build a really big, prosperous business in Dubai, you got to survive the first few years. But by the time you're 10 years old, you're in autopilot. Your business will be a cash machine if you can live that, survive that long. That's it. Start the business. Survive those difficult first few years. That's what I'm in the business of doing right now. Do things that will secure your business. I know for us to secure our business right now is we've got to do something that I'd failed to do with DocMan. And that's we've got to open more and more schools. And that's what we're doing. And survive. 10 years, you're sitting on a cash machine. If it's boring, you can sell it, but it's a cash machine.
If you can get it up to 10 years.
If you can get it up to 10 years.
So that's the mark. Go for the 10-year mark. And you know, it almost makes me think of, you know, one of my favorite success mantras, where I actually came from Sam Barnett, the CEO of NBC, who says, you know, success is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And I think when you open and take that longer view, you know, you become more resilient. You become more grounded. You become more even keeled. You get more focused. You know, if you trip in a 100-meter sprint, you're going to be really upset. And you're going to quit. You're going to quit. You're not going to keep running. If you trip in a marathon, you're not going to worry. Your friend who won't even worry, he'll stop and wait for you to get up. You could stop and tie your shoelace, you know, and keep going. It's not going to be an issue.
And make a lot of friends along the way.
Well, I think you have to, because as an entrepreneur, isn't it, you have no work-life balance, right? Your work is your life.
Your work
so
is
the people you work with better be your friends. Otherwise, they'll be a bit lonely.
I don't know this myself, of course, but my wife tells me I do cash flows in my sleep.
You do cash flows in your sleep.
Yes.
So when you look at it, in the Middle East, you know, is strategy important or is it more tactical? I mean, you know, you paid for these reports, but on one hand, you don't really know what the student wants or where the real money in the business is until you're actually on the ground tactically running it, right?
Strategy works. I think that, but here's my take for whatever it's worth, okay? I don't believe that a 5-year or a 10-year business plan for starting a business is really very, very valuable. Because when we started DocMan, I knew we had a business plan which said we were going to go in a particular direction. When I sold the company to Aramex, it was a very different business to what we'd originally conceived. It's just the way the market pushes you around and your learning curve along the way. Your business will...
You were saying that, you know, writing a business plan is one thing, but when you actually execute it, you know, the business that you write on paper is very different from the business that you run, is very different from the one that you sell.
No, thanks, Shane. I kind of lost myself over there.
No problem.
But yes, that's right. So, but what I think is very, very important is your launch plan. How do you get your business launched? You know, everything you do, all that planning to get it up and running, that first 6 months, the first 100-day plan that you have, 6-month plan and the 1-year plan, that's real. That is something that you really, really do want to think through. I think anything more strategic than that is useful. You need a North Star to guide you, to have a sense of purpose, a sense of direction, sure.
Okay, you need that North Star, but you can't be married to it, and you have to know when to be flexible and when to push through. These are the tricky moments. Well, I want to thank you so much. I mean, we're basically running out of time, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, and it's been a pleasure, and hopefully maybe we can have you on again. And if I ever need any cooking lessons, which I think many people may agree that I do, I'll definitely give you a ring.
Thanks for having me on the show, Shane.